Ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce to you Mrs. Lyndon B. Johnson.
Sit down, everybody. Sit down. Welcome, friends. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you here to meet Betty Ford. I like to see the LBJ Library being used for causes that are matters of concern to us all. I know it would have made Lyndon happy. I've known Betty and her husband Jerry, Lyndon and I did, from early 1949 when they came to Congress. We became friends and were in a club together and saw quite a lot of each other through those Washington years. And don't imagine, y'all, that there's a hostile gap between people who are Democrats and people who are Republicans. In a way, we were all workers in the same vineyard for what we hoped was the good of our country. And so I have shared many things with Betty and have great respect and affection and admiration for her, because she's a woman of courage and because she's willing to work for those things that life has taught her need working on. So it's just a joy to have Betty here with me in the LBJ Library, and here she is.
Thank you, Mrs. Johnson. You'll hear in just a moment from Mrs. Ford. In the meantime, may I welcome you on behalf of the Austin Council on Alcoholism to this happy get-together. My name is Dan Love. I serve at the pleasure of this board as president of the Austin Council, which is made up of citizens throughout our Central Texas community. There are 30 of us who serve as board members. It's a good cross-section of our community, and the executive committee of that board sits on the stage with me here today, and I'd like for you to meet them very briefly, if I may. Dr. Stuart Bogner, Judge Harriet Murphy, Garland Shearer, Dr. Ted Dake, and Jim Donahue. They are our executive committee. And at the same time, I'd like to recognize Dr. Shirley Skaggs, who sits with us. Shirley, would you stand, please? Dr. Skaggs is director of the Renaissance Program at Shoal Creek Hospital, and Shoal Creek hosted a coffee and a punch just prior to this meeting today for Mrs. Ford and Mrs. Johnson and members of our board. Thank you very much, Shirley, for being with us today. Back last fall, I suppose it was in September, perhaps in October, the Austin Council was making every effort to make its plans for 1980 in establishing our annual meeting, which involves the presentation of honors and so forth. And we had ambitious plans to select an outstanding speaker, inasmuch as we had set a precedent in the preceding year when Congressman Wilbur Mills was in Austin. Well, it occurred to one of our board members that the ideal person to appear for the council in February would be Betty Ford. And that ambition seemed to be completely out of sight and out of reach. However, through the efforts of one of our board people in particular, and through many telephone calls and a lot of communication, and a lot of asking, a lot of giving, and a lot of taking, we were able to secure as our special guest speaker in February, Mrs. Ford. Unfortunately, on the day of that program, some of you who were there remember that she was unable to be with us because she was stricken with the flu just a couple of days before our annual luncheon. She promised us that if we held the luncheon, she'd still come and visit us in the form of a reception. We so advised you of that, and today is the culmination of all of those plans, which were set aside just briefly back in February, but which have materialized on this day. The lady who persevered and kept it going and kept our chins up on this end, is the lady who will introduce our very special guest. And I want you to give a very, very warm welcome to a member of our board of directors on the Austin Council and a dear, dear lady, Mary Love Bailey.
This is a culmination today of one of the most fun quests that I've ever undertaken. This really started about a year ago in April, and it seemed so completely out of reach that we really didn't think it would ever happen. But through the friendship of our own beloved First Lady, Lady Bird, and working with her, and I really want to give all the credit to her. I think without her, Betty probably never would have come to Austin. But anyway, we are so grateful. And it was just so much fun getting to know Marion Evans, her secretary. Marion, would you stand up, because everybody's heard about you. And many, many other people. It was even the operators of the telephone company began to know me. And President Ford's office, I just knew all of them, and they are just wonderful. And then Lady Bird's three secretaries, I think I talk to them almost every day from that time to this. Anyway, we are just so grateful to everything that made possible having Betty Ford with us. We all admire her so much, and she is so human, and she has had so many of the problems that all of us have had. And, you know, the thing that is interesting to me is that years ago I had problems, but I didn't tell anybody. If they didn't accidentally find out about it, they didn't know, and I put on a happy face. And a lot of people in Austin never thought I ever had a problem. But Betty Ford had the courage to talk about hers, and the press loved it, and all of us loved it. She is so human and so lovable and so precious. And the fact that she didn't get to come in February made the difference between our being acquaintances and becoming friends. And for that, I am so grateful. And I am so grateful to all of you for coming. I'm just sorry everybody couldn't be here. But anyway, we love you and appreciate your support. And without further ado, I would like to introduce to you, and I'm not going to do it again, I know her last name. Her name is Betty Bloomer Ford, and we love her.
Thank you. Marilyn, I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to finally be here after all that you have prepared and so forth. And I must tell you that Mary Love Bailey worked harder than anyone I have ever known to make an event come possible. And then when at the last minute I had to get a bronchial type of pneumonia that made me low and I couldn't travel, I truly was disappointed. But she's right about those phone calls. The operators did get to know her, and it was one of those things. In fact, it's almost worth writing about. She tells it well, though. But it's such a pleasure to finally be here, and I'm so grateful that we're able to be here in the LBJ Library, and we all are so grateful for your very First Lady of Texas and our First Lady, former First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson, for the support she has given us by allowing us to be here and by being here herself. It's a tremendous boost for my morale. And it's a tremendous boost, I'm sure, for the Austin Council on Alcoholism. And Lady Bird, we really appreciate it. You have no idea. I remember well all, not all, but many of the fine, wonderful things that she did in Washington, and with the help of women in the many years, and they're all very substantive, just such as this is. And I feel very strongly that by her being here, it's very meaningful for the whole sort of event and thing that we're trying to accomplish. So thank you very much. Being here also brings back a lot of memories. 4 years ago I was here. I actually was rather busy trying to help my husband 4 years ago. And at that time, I hit quite a few cities, including Austin. And one of my trips was to the LBJ Library, and Mrs. Johnson received me with her daughter and her family. And I was ever grateful and am ever grateful for that. So it's really nice. It's quite a bit like coming home. And it's gratifying to me to think that some of you remember from February that you did have a rain check to come back after that luncheon. Pat Benedict gave me a very fine report of the luncheon. She brought home a tape, brought back a tape to me, and I enjoyed listening to the presentation of all awards. And that was very meaningful, as long as I couldn't be there with you all. Pat sent her very best, and I was delighted during the reception today to hear many of you speak of her and how much you enjoyed her talk. She's now no longer with the Navy. She's retired, and she's teaching a nurse's course at the different universities, a three-day course for alcoholism, as far as nurses are concerned, to learn about alcoholism and how to treat it. So she's very busy, and she sent her very best wishes to you all. But it's you people that I feel that are the people that are able to do what needs to be done in the field, such as I feel carrying the message is probably one of the most important things we can do. Because if we go out with an understanding of what alcoholism is and are willing to talk about it and try and make others understand about it, make them realize in many cases a difficult situation that it is a disease, and it's not just a lack of willpower, as so many people think, then we are teaching others and getting an education to the out into the field so that more people will be more comfortable. They'll feel less stigma as far as alcoholism is concerned. And thus, more people will seek help and more people will become well. I'm glad that among those that are here today and at the reception, there were two of the ladies that were unable to be, a gentleman and a lady who were unable to be here before for the luncheon, and Cecil Cabanis, who has 31 years, he told me, in AA. And that's a tremendous record. And we're just delighted that he is. He probably has, I'm told he's probably contributed more to the program here in Austin than anyone else. And who knows, because it travels all over, whatever you contribute, probably contributed more to maybe the West or even the whole country. So congratulations to you. We're glad you're back, Cecil. And also congratulations for Leroy Gann, who is also a volunteer, and she was unable to be here, and I had a visit with her. So everybody know they're well, and they're back, and cheers for her. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I'm doing today. I know Pat Benedict delivered my remarks last time, And so I thought perhaps before we open it to questions and answers, I would be trying to explain what I'm up to, so to speak, other than trying to stay sober a day at a time, Beth. But we are in the process of starting to fund a new treatment center, which will be in connection with the Eisenhower Medical Center in Rancho Mirage there in New Palm Springs. I am heading it up with Leonard Firestone, the fundraising project, and we're making our plans for construction. And this treatment center will be somewhat similar to the one at Hazelden up in Minnesota. Perhaps there are some of you who are aware of that arrangement at Hazelden in Minnesota. We will have separate buildings from the hospital. There will be a cluster of buildings with maybe 20 beds to each individual unit, and hopefully 6 of those units when we complete, so that it would be 120 bed treatment center. It is for not only treatment, but it's for treatment and, more importantly, for education, and also what we hope will be prevention. I feel that in order to make progress toward prevention, which is our ultimate aim, we need to educate the family, the public, and there are many doctors who, as yet, doctors, nurses, counselors, clergymen, even administrators for other treatment centers. There's just so much to be learned. And I repeat what Dr. Kirsch says about the 4-2-1 syndrome, and it always seems worth telling to me, because in medical school, there are only 4 years of medical school, there are only 2 hours spent on training for alcoholism, when it is the number one public problem and disease. And this is something that has to be corrected. So we hope with not only treating patients, we will be educating. And in educating, we will be able to have doctors recognize alcoholism, learn how to treat it, and in turn be willing to diagnose it, which in many cases they are not. Also, in the treatment center, we hope to have an intervention type of program. And someone spoke to me today and said that the intervention program had increased considerably since my book had come out with the last chapter on Long Beach, because I wrote about the family and intervention in my book. Intervention was used on me, and I felt it was important to explain it as best I could when I wrote about Long Beach, so that other people would perhaps seek out help through that means. We'd love to have intervention on wheels, but that would be quite a dream come true, so that we could go into the home with a team and help the family with an intervention or confrontation. As I said, the education part is going to be directed, of course, to the medical profession and the clergy and also the administrators who have to do. And the prevention, which I heard, well, I have to go back, because I heard a lecture on prevention. A man came in and he was to speak at our awareness hour, which has been a very successful thing the last 4 years at Eisenhower. And he said, I'm supposed to speak on alcoholism, but I'm not interested in, that bores me. I want to speak on prevention. And ever since then, I guess it's sort of stimulated my interest to a very high degree, and I think that I have considered that the ultimate goal that I would like to work for. And I realized that with the patient treatment and with the education of the public through awareness and the education of the medical profession and so on, perhaps we will then get to a prevention. The more the public knows, the more the people surrounding, whether they're in the family or relatives or people they're working for, whatever the relationship is, the more they know, the more we're going to have early detection. And with early detection, it's just such a boon for alcoholism. Instead of having to become so badly destroyed by the disease, that early detection, and I think prevention will bring that to a great extent. And I feel strongly that in the schools with the young people we have today, the teenagers, it shocked me to think that they say that they have turned, shocks me to think they were on drugs, but now they turn to something called alcohol, which is cheaper and easier to get. And this is so sad for our young people. And they need to be educated. So we need to train counselors to go into the school and explain to them what it's all about. I appreciate being here today. I'm not going to talk long because I have agreed to answer some questions. And when you agree to answer questions, you really put your life on the line, believe me. I've done it twice already today, and I don't know whether I have any answers left, but I'll be delighted to. And this is Mr. Donahue, who is going, would you like to say a few words?
I don't know what I could follow after what you said.
No.
Mrs. Ford has indicated that she wanted the opportunity to be able to interact with the people in Austin, Texas. And the way that we have devised and set up today for that to happen, I'm sure you observe that there are microphones in the aisle. I'd like to ask that if you have a question, and I surely hope you have questions for Mrs. Ford, that you would approach the microphone, and in doing so, simply introduce yourself and be as comfortable as you can, and just ask a question to Mrs. Ford, and she will be glad to respond to it. Now, who's going to be first? Thank you for the lights.
He's almost as good as Phil Donahue, isn't he? And I did Phil Donahue one time.
Would you tell us your name, please?
Oh, I'm Phil Donahue.
Thank you.
You spoke about training
doctors, nurses, doctors, pre-hospital, and
abusing,
and
then
with
an alcoholic
death. I'm sorry, I can't.
The question you're asking is, in training of medical doctors, do you think they will have the patience necessary to spend?
I think you're referring to the counselors who, in most cases, have actually had experience with alcohol on a personal basis. And having been through that period, usually it's 2 or 3 years later, then they counsel patients that need help. Yes, I think this is possible. Perhaps not for treatment, but the most important thing, to teach them to be willing to recognize it with their everyday patients. I think doctors turn away many patients because they really do not want to tell their patient. They know that that patient has a problem. And they will avoid in every way facing it themselves that it is an alcoholic problem. They'll put them in the hospital for a respiratory problem or something else and get them to the point where they can go home. And but it's like, if you're probably familiar with it, it's sort of that unending system. They go home for a while, and then they're back in the hospital again, and they go out again, and they're back in the hospital. So they would recommend a treatment center to the patient. I do not mean that they would be actually treating them. It's education for the doctor. Does that answer your question?
Gentlemen at the microphone, would you tell us your name, please?
Yes, I'm Reuben Stafford, and I'm an alcoholic. And Mrs. Ford mentioned, you know, an intervention program. We're trying to get an intervention program off the ground. She mentioned also, you know, the fact that she herself was a subject of intervention. There's some questions in my mind as to just how effective this intervention can be, and that generally, I'm wondering if this intervention program is directed primarily at the family or at the person that may have the drinking problem. It's my understanding, as the way I feel, if they're intervening in a crisis situation where a person is drunk or incapacitated, you're asking a rational or an irrational person to make a rational decision. And I'm wondering just how much opposition that the person that really needs the help most.
Is your question how effective can an intervention be and under what circumstances?
Yes, that's correct.
First of all, I want to understand that an intervention is not a 12-step call, which in my mind you're more or less referring to if somebody is incapacitated. And I think of that as more of a 12-step call for one alcoholic to another alcoholic. Intervention is a method of the family. The family is actually coached by a counselor or a doctor, whoever, somebody that knows how, exactly how to face the problem with individual, actually each member of the family speaks to, they meet with the alcoholic at a time when they can all face that member together. And it is done with a great deal of love and caring. It is done not to point out the fact that they are, you know, disgusting or anything like that. It is done when the alcoholic is sober, not when they are drinking.
That's fine. That answers my question. Thank you very much. And I'm glad you're here.
I'd like to put a plug in. If you're interested in knowing more about the intervention in Austin, let me recommend that you communicate with the Renaissance Program at Shoal Creek Hospital. They have an excellent intervention program here in Austin. Yes, ma'am. Your question, please.
Mrs. Ford, I'm Libby Slaughter, and I'm one of the two Hatters, and I work in the field of alcoholism. And I would like to know what you think about in the future, or what you see in the future of consistent treatment over the nation for alcoholism and in legislation processes. Of course, I don't need to remind everyone of the inflation thing and the money. And since by your own admission that this is the number one health problem in the nation, and I certainly agree with you, I wonder, do you see anything that's going to come from the congressmen and the senators and the people who run our country about the funds? You know, I'm talking about overall treatment through the nation.
So what you're asking
legislation.
Is, what's the future hold for the disease of alcoholism from a legislative point of view?
Right.
So. I think that probably in the future, and you're speaking in the future, the federal government will have to address it. There have been grants, you know, already from HEW. We haven't been as happy with the grants that have been made. I'm new to this. I'm not on the National Council. I have not gotten into any of the legislative bills, and I really can't advise you. I do know that we are working independently, because this particular center that I'm referring to in California, in Eisenhower Medical Center, Friday I'll be in Sacramento meeting with two of the heads of committees to see how the legislature will recognize third-party payment for our center, because it is not an acute center. The acute detox will be done in the hospital. We are merely a treatment center, and if you're aware of it, the third-party payees such as insurance, will pay for acute treatment. Acute mm-hmm. treatment, which is much more expensive than the treatment we're referring to. We hope to, instead of have it cost whatever hospital, then heaven knows that's very high today and going up, for 28 days, we would hope that only the detox would be done in the hospital, and then the treatment center would be maybe somewhere around $100 a day, mm-hmm. which the insurance would pay for. At this point, they will not pay for that, and we're trying to make a case test that perhaps will lead the way for other treatment centers.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your question. Yes, sir.
My name's Rich, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. Mrs. Ford, this may be too personal, but if it is, don't answer. Does the president have alcohol in your home? And if he does, and I'm sure you do a lot of entertaining, how do you handle that with the drink? Does it bother you with the drinking going on in your home if it does?
Well, I'll be glad to answer it. Very easily, I drink. I drink Perrier, I drink ginger ale, and it doesn't make a bit of difference. No, we have alcohol in our home. We have never removed it from the home. We serve it, and I didn't mean to be facetious, but people sometimes ask me, well, what do you do now that you can't drink? And I say, I just say, oh, well, I drink. And they look very shocked. But I do, I think alcoholics sometimes are very sensitive about that because we drink milk and coffee and tea and everything. Drinking is not alcohol. Alcoholism is a different thing. Yes, we do. We have never stopped serving it, and I'm very fortunate. It doesn't bother me a bit. I'm one of the lucky ones that once the doctors told me that I didn't need it, and I shouldn't drink it, and it was harmful to me, and it was doing a lot of damage, I guess I used my head and said, no way will I touch it. And that was sort of the end. So I'm lucky. I hear about others that have a problem, but I don't think.
Ma'am, one other thing I'd like to throw in. When I woke up this morning, I was thinking about you and Mrs. Johnson, and I was very disappointed with the weather because I wanted it to be just a perfect day here for you. And I gave a little prayer, and I think when I pray, things happen.
The sun came out.
Thank you for the question and, of course, for the prayer. Yes, ma'am.
Mrs. Ford, I'm Doris Tyler, and I'm an Al-Anon. I would like to know if when this treatment facility is finished, will part of the treatment program be directed towards the families, or will it be entirely for the alcoholic?
Oh, by all means. I'm sorry I didn't make that explicit. Obviously, I had a few notes down here, and that was all. It was quite obvious. I missed that point because it... In most of our treatment, then we already have an outpatient program, it is mandatory for the family to participate. I really don't feel that the alcoholic can recover without the family understanding. And family sometimes is sicker than the alcoholic, particularly a spouse. They've been defending them and covering up for them for so long that they really don't know how to handle it when they have to turn around and say, I'm going to live my own life, and your problems are not my problems. And it's very hard to teach some family, particularly a spouse.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Ford, I'm Jack Tyler. I'm the other half of that one. We just up here, and you're right. She was sicker than I was. I tried to get our oldest daughter one time to help me get Mama some help. She was sick. I have a question that, if I don't put it right, which I probably won't, it could have political connotations, but I don't mean it that way. The Carter administration has proposed a balanced budget within which some of the monies to health services will not be provided. And alcoholism would be one of them. That being the main one that we're interested in. The monies coming to the states, known as federal formula grant monies, would be that which would be cut off. But the monies for direct projects coming direct out of NIAAA or HEW to the states would be increased. A solution for that, and still allow them to balance their budget without increasing the money, would be to half that, allowing NIAAA to have the half for direct projects and the other half go to the states for the federal formula grants. The question is, have you or President Ford been aware of this, and if so, what position would you take?
I think I understand the question. First of all, I haven't taken a position, and I don't feel that I'm well enough informed to take a position. I'm aware that NIHH is getting more money than, as you say. I would hope that both of them would get more money, and that would be what would be my recommendation. Whether that's possible or not, I don't know. I believe there was some money that was promised back about a year or two ago by HEW, and I think that, due to balancing the budget, we missed out on. My husband is very supportive as far as legislature in this field. Just recently we both wrote to President Carter about how desirable we thought it would be to have Senator Harold Hughes head up a commission that they are considering, and we thought he would be the man that would know and understand, having been through it himself. And he would be a good spokesman for the committee, which will be made up of congressional members and, I believe, I think it's a House committee. It's not in the Senate, but it's a House committee. So the more we are informed about it, the more we can do. I haven't had much time to study on it. As I say, I'm not really technically equipped.
Thank you, Ms. Ford. We're glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Jack. Yes, ma'am.
Betty, I'm Audrey Thomas from San Antonio, and I couldn't help but just admire, of course, you ever since all this has happened. And I don't mean to get too personal, but I know what I'm an alcoholic, and I know what a terrible thing it was for me to have to admit that I was an alcoholic. Anything else, but not an alcoholic. Being just about the next step you can get from the top person in the whole United States and being in public life, it must have taken the guts of a Texas mule to admit this and do what you're doing. Right?
Is that your question?
Yes, that's my question.
If she has the guts of a Texas mule. Is that your question?
Really, my question was, I can imagine how hard it was for me. It must have been 5,000 times harder for her being in the public like she was. Nobody knew me but my people in Central Texas. And it must have been a tremendous thing for you to have done this and didn't it just take everything you had. Much courage.
How difficult was it to...
Yeah. Damn, how long did it take you to do it, for heaven's sake?
Well, yes, it did take the guts of a Texas mule. There's no question about that. I think I can best explain it by, and this is what we hope to get across to people, it's the support of my family and the fact that all my
children were there, and my husband and I flew home, and the fact that they made the effort, and the fact that they cared enough to want me to get well, made me realize how much they loved me. And when we all met together in the living room that day with the help of some doctors who had coached them, I felt a tremendous amount of love. And this is what I think it's all about. We had always been a closely knit family, and I knew that they cared. And consequently, knowing how much they cared, I wanted to get well. And you say, well, you could have gone to some private place where nobody would have known about it. And that was my decision. I decided that we were public people, and if this was a problem with me, then the best thing to do was to be honest about it and not try and say, well, she's got a, you know, bad case of hives or something, and she's got up. Or so it was my decision, along with the family. They agreed, and I wanted to go to what I thought was the best place. And when I knew I had a problem, actually I was quite anxious to face up to it and take care of it as quickly as I could and get on with my life, because I didn't have time to be messed up that way. So it took guts on my family's part too. I think they were the gutsy people. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for that question. I am traveling, and I am speaking to different groups and raising money. We have a committee that is in the process of raising money. We are approaching foundations. We are approaching individuals. We have found, and it's interesting to me, that the people that are most interested in helping are the people who have had some experience with alcoholism in their family. Either they themselves have been through the experience or someone in their family. And so it makes it a very limited group that we find that are willing to give. But we're about halfway there, and we expect to make it by next year. Thank you.
Your question, please.
I'm on the board of the Austin Council, and I'm concerned about treatment facilities for women and wonder what your experience has been with that. I think in Texas there are less than 25 spaces available for women alcoholics who need to bring their children with them, and I think in the state there's probably less than 100 spaces available. Can you comment on that?
What you're asking is a comment in regards to treatment placements that are available for
women, and particularly for women with children. I think that the women alcoholic has been ignored to a large degree, mm-hmm. and a woman alcoholic with young children who needs to have them with her during her treatment process is really out in the cold.
And you're wanting to know what Mrs. Ford's feelings are
yeah,
about that issue.
Or what plans she has in her treatment center for those okay. kinds of things.
I guess kind of what kind of provisions are you making in this new facility you're talking about for women and children?
That's a very good point. We had such a treatment center in Palm Springs, and unfortunately I was not with it in any way, but I heard about it. And it folded because the women couldn't pay, and of course that's the big thing, and this is what we're going to Sacramento about, is to try and make this transition from acute care to treat wake. I think you're speaking more of like a halfway house. I spoke at a halfway house in California in last fall, I guess it was, one of the first talks I made, my daughter went with me, and that was quite an eye-opener for the news. Somebody said, I made news. We really made news that night on every channel, a mother and her daughter talking on alcoholism. But it was to raise funds for a halfway house. And I agree with you, there are very few treatments in just for women, if you mean that. There are many centers, but to get children in, that's another problem. I think it should be addressed, and I understand right here in Austin it is being addressed with a center that will soon be opened, and perhaps there's somebody here who can speak on that.
25 places for women for a state. I mean, or for Craig County or Austin.
Well, I think when I...
It's a wonderful step.
It is a marvelous step, and I hope that it will lead the way for more, because when I spoke, I was amazed to find out for strictly women, I believe there were only 70 in the country compared to the thousands there are for men. So we do need them, and to speak to address the problem is an excellent idea, and I wish you luck with this one.
The facility you mentioned is Austin Family House, and I was told today that it's going to open Monday? June 1st. I think June 1st is when it's going to be open. Yes, ma'am, your question.
Betty, my name is Pat Fisk, and I'm a grateful Al-Anon. I agree with you that very often the rest of the family is as sick, if not sicker, than the alcoholic. And I've really been working on this Al-Anon, but I'd like to say that our rich book loved it. Give you a little plug here.
Thank you.
I'd love for you to autograph it if you have time. One of the things that in your treatment, you had a drug problem as well as alcoholism. I believe it was a prescription drugs, if I'm not. This, you had help in being taken off these prescription drugs. My concern is... my husband went to AA, but he's still being kept on prescription medication, prescription drugs, and I'm concerned about this, and I'm trying to, have the wisdom to know the difference in what I can change and what I can't change, but this is something that's of concern to me, and I'd like for you to address that, if you would.
So what you're asking about has to do with the combination of alcohol and drugs, and what kind of things are possible once you abstain from the alcohol to then look at abstaining from the drugs. Is that what you're asking?
Right.
When a medical doctor is prescribing the drug to the person. Tough. Real tough.
Well, there is that problem, and I think this is why doctors need to be educated in the field of alcoholism, because too often they use drugs for withdrawal when it isn't necessary, and the patient gets addicted to the drug, and then you have another complication. I feel that, and I have advised people who have written, I get a lot of mail such as this, what do I do? My doctor says I have to take thus and so, and I need it, and I generally think the patient probably wants to take it in the first place, and they probably want the doctor to tell them they have to take it, but I suggest they have a talk with the doctor, and if he will not review the case and explain to them, then they find and discuss it with another doctor, and for many cases you have to change doctors. And this, in some cases, is the reason doctors don't want to deal with alcoholism, because they're afraid that their patient will leave them if they actually say, I think you don't have a problem with your heart or a problem with your lungs. You really have a problem with alcoholism, and the patient doesn't want to hear that. And so they're afraid they'll go to somebody else. But I think if you're trying to do something, you're going to have to deal with the doctor himself.
Oh, I thought we exhausted the audience. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I would really like to have your autograph, Mrs. Ford. I have a 16-year-old son who knew I was coming here today, and he gets autographs of world-class runners, and I said, well, I'm going to go hear Mrs. Ford and meet her today. And he said, yeah, Mom, tell me another one. So if I don't go home with an autograph, I don't know if he'll believe me.
I have a schedule, but I will try and do something.
Mrs. Ford has a schedule she must keep to, but she has said she will try to do some. Okay? Thank you. Are there any other questions? Yes.
I'm Joy Feeding. I'm beginning to be a grateful alcoholic. And I'd kind of like to know if your husband goes to Al-Anon, and if he realized that you had a medical problem, and that did he realize right away that alcoholism is an illness?
You're kind of asking what was the perception of Mr. Forbes as it relates to the problem of alcoholism, right? Okay.
I'm glad you are getting to be a grateful alcoholic, because there's nothing greater than a grateful alcoholic. I thought that was a pretty funny thing or strange thing at first, but I too have found that it is great. When you ask about him, he also went for treatment such as Al-Anon family treatment, and spent, I would say, at least 5 or 6 days off and on at the same facility that I went to. So he learned through others what it was all about. My treatment was predicated on the family participation. And I think most treatment should be. Very seldom do I think that it should be done. Certainly there's no guarantee unless you have the family cooperation.
That's all the time we have for questions. Mrs. Ford, I want to thank you for your candidness on behalf of the audience, and as well as myself personally, to have the opportunity to visit with you, and the Austin Council on Alcoholism thanks you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Before you depart, I would like to call Garland Shearer to the stage to make a small presentation to you.
Mrs. Ford, in February, as you know, you sent a marvelous emissary in Pat Benedict. We were charmed by Pat, and the message that you sent was both moving and heartwarming and encouraging. For that, we thank you. But there will never be, in the hearts of Austin, anybody closer to us than Betty Ford. We so appreciate your coming. We admire your courage, and therefore would like to give you this very, very small token, but nonetheless heartfelt. Incidentally, the bow is a little smashed because I had it hidden in the recesses of a closet so my 2-year-old couldn't get it. For 3 months. Thank you.
How nice.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I want to open this while you're all right here. Please don't go away for a minute, so I can thank you personally all.
While Mrs. Ford is opening the present, I forgot to introduce the man who makes it all happen at the Austin Council, our Executive Director, Jim Hill.
I'm going to break a finger, Hill, I know.
There.
Thank you. I knew there was something women couldn't do. Open packages.
Forgive me.
Thank you. Oh, isn't this pretty? Has another little surprise about it. Oh, this is lovely. Just beautiful, and just beautiful. Little pendant.
With a butterfly. And one last comment from John Hayes. John?
Thank you. I'm John Hayes, an alcoholic, and I'd like to, on behalf of the Suburban AA Group and the Suburban Alcoholic Foundation, present our lovely member here, Betty Ford, her medallion
for 2 years of sobriety.
Thank you.
Our friends from the Secret Service have asked, would you keep your seat while Mrs. Ford leaves, please? Be just a moment.
Thank you all very much.